Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. Well, on a pretty regular basis, parents are told that television, maybe even more broadly, that spending a lot of time looking at some kind of screen is bad for their children. It's bad for their physical health. It's bad for their cognitive development. It's bad for their behavior. And the question we'd like to try to raise here this morning is television really as bad as all that? And what about educational programming that is created specifically for children? Well, our guest for the program this morning is Barbara Wilson. She is professor of communication here at the University of Illinois. Her research has looked at both social and psychological effects of media, particularly on young people. She has done a lot of writing on this subject, including a book which she co-authored titled Children, Adolescents, and the Media. And three book volumes of the National Television Violence Study, going back to the late 1990s. More recently, she's done some study of children's programming, that is, programming that's specifically made for and advocated as programming for children, and says something about the quality of what's available out there. So we want to talk about that and maybe also more generally about what we know about the effect of television and other kinds of screens on children. Questions are certainly welcome here in on the program. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. It's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455 at any point here. Questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to keep their comments and questions brief just so we can keep moving along. But anybody who is welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, again, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Our, as we were talking just a little bit before we started here, I think our interest was certainly caught. A lot of people, I'm sure, saw some of the stories a couple of months ago. It was early December, about a study that had been done. And this was one of those studies where they looked at a lot of other studies, trying to determine the effects of spending a lot of time watching television, or it could be in front of a computer, it could be playing video games, screen time, effect on heavy screen time on children. And that the conclusions were not exactly new, at least this is the kind of thing we've heard before, that it's bad. The more time is bad for their physical health, just like with an adult. If you just sat around all the time, it wouldn't be very good for you. But also that you could see the impact of particular kinds of programming on kids and their behavior in ways that parents would not be happy about. So to start there, I guess a parent would just have to say, well, is it really as bad as all that? Should I take the television and toss it out the front door?
I think that would be one conclusion you could draw, but it wouldn't be a conclusion I would endorse. Actually, I'm a parent, and I'm happy to say that I have televisions in my home. In fact, more than one television in my home. And I think that if you look carefully at the research, it's not so simplistic as to say, don't watch television, don't sit in front of a screen, get rid of all of these technologies. In fact, there are many good things out there, many good programs, websites, places that children can learn a great deal. And what it really boils down to is that content matters. What children are doing with which kind of messages, which kind of programs or websites makes a big difference. Some of them can be very educational, very positive, very instructive. Others can be educational, but maybe not the kinds of things that parents want children to learn.
Well, that that would be, I'm sure, a major area of concern, because one of the things this particular study looked at was things like the impact of watching a lot of television on behaviors that parents would just as soon, you know, not see their children engage in, things like smoking, things like sexual behavior. And I guess there the message is that, well, if you watch a lot of programs where people are smoking and where people are engaging in a lot of sex, that somehow that tends to reinforce those behaviors and make it more likely then that the watchers will engage in them. I mean, is there good reason to believe that that kind of modeling really does go on?
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence to suggest or to indicate, really, that children learn things from television. Like they learn things in the classroom, they learn things from parents. Television can be, and other forms of media can be, a source of inspiration and instruction to children. And I think the critical questions are, how are the messages about health and about violence and about sexuality being portrayed? It's not so much if it's there, children will learn. It's how these kinds of messages are portrayed. So, for example, you can show violence on the screen and actually encourage children not to engage in violence. It depends on how you portray it. Mm-hmm. If you glamorize it, if you sanitize it, if you show it as the most interesting and useful way of solving problems, children will learn that that's a good thing to do. If you, on the other hand, show it in a way that it's realistic, where you show the real-life consequences to the victim, and you suggest that there are alternative strategies for solving problems, you can actually reduce children's likelihood to endorse aggression as a technique for solving problems. You can say similar things about sexuality. If you glamorize sex, if you show a lot of depictions of sex outside of committed relationships, if you fail to show the health consequences of engaging in certain forms of sexual behavior, you again are glamorizing those kinds of behaviors. And we know that much of television entertainment does that. It fails to show us the serious consequences of engaging in particular sexual behaviors, especially when you're young and outside of committed relationships. Yeah, so, again, for me, it's content matters and context matters.
And that, I think you point at the what I'm sure a lot of parents will say, is that a lot of what's available on television doesn't do the good thing. Doesn't do what you would like. It doesn't really present you with a good teachable moment. That it actually does the other. That it is more likely to enforce a different kind of view of those things, not the kind of view that you would really like.
Right, but I'm glad that you raised the teachable moment issue, because to me, I mean, one response to all of this is to shut off the television and get rid of the computer. But I think a far more proactive and beneficial approach from a parent's perspective is to actually use some of the perhaps unfortunate portrayals to teach children the alternatives. And we actually have research that shows that parents who engage in what we call critical viewing skills, teaching of critical viewing skills and critical media skills, media literacy is another term that's been used in the business, if you will, that those children can actually show a great deal of sophisticated thinking about the media, and they show less likely to have the harmful effects that we're talking about. So you can use the media to instruct, but it, of course, requires an active parent who's nearby and who's engaging in media content with children. Unfortunately, much of what children do with the media is in isolation, and it's not very often that parents sit and watch programming or sit and surf the web with their children. In fact, when we talk to kids in large samples of studies across the country, we find that most children say, you know, I spend a lot of time in front of a screen by myself, and much of the technology I use is in my bedroom. So, in fact, parents might be surprised, or most grown-ups, adults might be surprised to learn how many kids in this country actually have televisions, computers, and even access to the internet, access to cable or to digital television in their bedrooms. And, you know, this presents a much bigger challenge for parents to monitor and be engaged in their children's media habits. Yeah.
And it's not that there is no way for parents to do that. There is, and there are various avenues for parents to exercise some control.
Right.
But it's something that they have to. It takes effort. It takes a deliberate effort on parents' part. And as you say, I think for a lot of people, if everybody's busy, everybody's in some room doing their own thing, parents could be sitting in front of another screen doing something else. And, you know, this idea. We've been telling this to parents for a long time. You know, the idea would be everybody sits down and watches together. Mm-hmm. Parents know what children see, and there's some opportunity for some dialogue about what it is that's watching. But that, I don't know who actually has time and opportunity to do that. And if anybody does that anymore, everybody all together, rather than having everybody off sort of doing their own thing.
Yeah. Well, I think some parents still do this, and you don't have to do it constantly. It's like anything. If you empower children to think critically, they'll do it on their own. So it's part of a habit, part of a practice. I mean, one of the challenges, I think, is that you get a lot of pressure from your kids to have technology in their bedrooms. I mean, both of my daughters would really like televisions in their bedrooms. And I've told them over and again, you know, sorry, you unfortunately have a mother who's a researcher in this area, and I am not going to change my mind, because all of the research shows that technology in the bedrooms makes all of this much more challenging, and the effects tend to be stronger for those children. So to me, it's just a simple case of, no, you're not going to have a TV in your bedroom. Mm-hmm. But I get pressure all the time for that. So yeah.
There you go, kids. When you pick your parents, don't pick people who do communication research.
That's right.
Our guest in this hour is Barbara Wilson. She's Vice Provost for Academic Affairs at the U of I. She is also professor in the Department of Communication, and is very much interested in social and psychological effects of media, particularly on young people. And that's what we're talking about. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have a caller to join in the conversation in Charleston, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I agree directly with everything you're saying about the social effects. I was wondering if you've done any research. I've got a comment and then a question about the physical effects of looking at a two-dimensional screen and seeing these three-dimensional objects. When I was a child, I fell asleep. I'm 24 years old. I didn't fall asleep, but I'd sit on my side in a dark room in my parents' bedroom and watch, like, let's say, the Dick Van Dyke Show. But I was always had my head turned to the side, and I was always, like, kind of on my back. And I've kind of developed a lazy eye out of that. But my question is, I have a 12-week-old nephew who, you know, my sister will sit there and kind of hold him, and all of a sudden I see his eyes start to turn to the TV, the television. Is there any type of physical effect that can play on the development of a child?
That's a really interesting question, and I guess the short answer is no, I don't think there is any research looking at the particular issue that you're raising. I can tell you, though, that there are an increasing number of studies that have looked at the impact of watching television on infants, because we don't know much about that. And it's a challenging area, because you can't actually talk to infants and ask them how they're interpreting what they're seeing. So you have to come up with novel measures to assess the impact. And one of the things that we're recognizing is that infants, who are watching things on the screen, compared to children who are observing behaviors in real life. So there are experiments where infants will watch somebody demonstrate something with an object. You know, this is a big part of learning when you're an infant. You have to learn how to manipulate objects and touch objects and learn how to grab things, and that's a major form of learning. And that, in fact, when infants watch those kinds of behaviors on the screen versus a real-life adult imitating those things, they learn much better from the real live person. They imitate more quickly. They're able to grasp the objects and do the kinds of things that the adult is doing much more readily when they see it in person than on the screen. It suggests that this three-dimensional issue is important in infant learning, and that when we put it on a two-dimensional screen, we're actually somehow reducing perhaps the cues that are available to a child to interpret the world or learn about the world. Now, that's not exactly what you're asking about, but I thought I would use it as an opportunity to suggest that plopping an infant down in front of a screen for an hour is understandable if you're busy and you're stressed out and you need a break, but having them play with toys in a playpen would probably be more instructional than screen time sitting in front of a two-dimensional kind of representation.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And it certainly is true that the American Academy of Pediatrics, now I'm not sure how long, this was maybe 5 or 6 years ago now, officially said, we don't think that children under two.
That's correct.
We don't think children under two should be watching television. So they specifically said to parents, you know, maybe you have this impulse that you are busy, you want to keep them occupied, sitting an infant down in front of the TV. They said, it is our considered opinion as pediatricians that that's not good we would say, please don't do that.
That's true. And that recommendation actually came out before much research on the topic. So it's actually in response to that recommendation that you see now a lot of research on infants and the media. And I think much of what's coming out reinforces or supports that recommendation and suggests that, frankly, parents urged to buy Baby Einstein videos and doing all of these kinds of things in the hopes of accelerating their child's intellectual development may actually be much safer or it would be a better recommendation for them to simply find educational toys and interact with your baby, you know, talk to your baby, play with your baby, give your baby a lot of social interaction around different kinds of things that you want them to learn.
Well, we talked a little bit, or I mentioned that there was this study, this big study of studies that was released in early December looking at the effects of a lot of screen time on kids that certainly made the observation that it was physically, it was not good for them if what they were doing was spending a lot of time in front of the screen to the exclusion of or instead of being physically active, playing, running around, playing basketball, you know, and doing whatever. That's obviously that's not good. It's not good for anybody. But going beyond the kind of physiological effects of inactivity, is there anything about what spending a lot of time looking at a screen, looking at things on a screen, has on brain or brain development?
There are some people looking at, in particular, the effect of watching violent programming on brain imaging and brain responses right now. But I think we're really in such an early stage in that research that I'm not really willing to talk about it with much confidence. I think it's going to be the wave of the future. But I will say that, you know, sitting in front of the screen for long hours in the day, obviously you want children to be active. That's a big part of their development. But one of the challenges and one of the concerns is not just the amount of time, but what they're seeing. And once again, I'm coming back to content. But what we have found in research is that children, it's really the exposure to advertising that may be a particular problem here in terms of thinking about children's food choices and thinking about physical fitness and particularly obesity. We know that children who are exposed to a lot of food ads, and by the way, most food advertisement on television, you probably know this if you watch TV, but it's not for for healthy foods. It's for sugared snacks and things, cereals that are mostly full of sugar and all kinds of non-nutritional foods. And so what we know is that children who watch a lot of television are also exposed, for the most part, to a lot of advertising that is not healthy. And in fact, when they watch television, they eat more and they eat more unhealthy food if they're sitting in front of a screen than if they're sitting at a table with the television turned off. So again, content matters.
All right. We have some other callers. Let's talk next with someone in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hi, great topic. Two short things. I think, of course, media reflects culture, but we do need to be aware of what influences media. And I think that's a great topic because, you know, poets used to sing songs about kings. It doesn't mean kings were great people. But one of the things I think about when you talk about education, and gosh, it's such a big field, people expect schools to do more than they're able to do. And unfortunately, I would say thinking in general is a good thing. And we call it critical thought, but it's really just about that social examination with another person of thought. And I think the person who was on earlier today put it very well when he discussed about dialogue. And I think that's what gets back to TV. While it's a very good medium, it's a very powerful medium, it has all this potential, it's not interactive, and that's what human beings, especially when they're developing, thrive on. So I just want to sit back and listen. Great show.
All right. Thank you. You can reflect on that any way you like.
Well, I think the caller is absolutely right. We have to think about why we have the messages we do. They are part of our culture. Many people will say to me, why do we have all this violence in the media? Or why do we have all of this sexual promiscuity in the media, you know, and part of it is our culture. Part of it is what people seem to be attracted to. Part of it is the media's industry, the media industry's unwillingness or nervousness about breaking out of the mold of what works and what pays well and what people seem to be attracted to. So I think those are really interesting questions to think about why we have the messages that we do. And the caller also raised the issue of critical thinking as part of what we do every day, and I couldn't agree more. There are efforts to teach critical media literacy in the schools, but of course many teachers say we're already inundated with too many things to teach children. Don't add this to our plate. But in fact, media do excite children, and they do care about what's out in the media. And so oftentimes it provides a vehicle for teaching things that children might not be so interested in otherwise.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Mm-hmm.
You talk about television. Are you speaking about children as below a certain age, like babies up to like what, five, or you deal with all children up to certain ages? What age do you stop at?
I've done research on children. I haven't done much work on infants, but I've studied children between about 3 and 17.
Okay, that's what I was thinking you were doing. But it's interesting because, you know, you talk about television, which is actually the least of your worries because there are some standards, whatever that means. You know, like they say certain words, they, you know, fine these people $400,000 or $500,000. But the Internet has become such an overwhelming force. I mean, all my nieces and nephews just live on the Internet practically, or they text, message each other through phones. And phones are now becoming Internet-enabled, like the iPhone and stuff like that. And there are virtually no standards in that medium. And it's also very interactive in that you can participate, which is good, I think, to some extent. But also, I mean, it's astonishing what some of these people look at and what they're absorbed by. And then you were talking about using screens and stuff. Right at this moment, there are people sitting in the Southern Command in Florida who are, you know, controlling drones, killing people vicariously because you see only thing this little blip on a screen, you know, an explosion from a Hellfire missile. And I find that sort of detachment because I spent 15 months in Southeast Asia 40 years ago. When you're there, it's a lot different than sitting in a little, you know, cubicle somewhere in Florida, you know, killing people. But I'm wondering if you think about that. And I'm very interested in your subject because I've asked the film critic on, or the person at this university teaches film, about the effects of this bombardment of media on people. I mean, almost like, are they inured to violence, or do they encourage violence? I mean, is this what you're dealing with? I'd like to know. Could you respond to that?
Sure. There is research on whether people can become desensitized to the media, in particular media violence. And the evidence is there, and it's, I think, quite compelling that even in short amounts of exposure, children who watch a lot of violence will report that it's more acceptable. They will also be less likely to intervene in helping other people. So there have been experiments where children don't know that they're sort of being set up in a particular situation, and if they watch a lot of violence, they're less likely to go and get help when they think they're observing a real fight compared to children who don't watch violence. So even in small studies like that, in short amounts of exposure, we see evidence for desensitization. There are also studies that have looked at long-term exposure, so not with so much with children because we have ethical concerns about that, but with adults, repeated exposure week after week to certain kinds of violence in the media can lead to desensitization, an acceptance of violence, if you will. Not necessarily that you'll go out and do it, but that you're more tolerant of it and that you react with less concern about real-world violence.
So are you, is your specialty, not particularly you, but let's say your field, are you trying to design programs, like educational programs where you teach people critical thinking? You mentioned that earlier, which I think is, as the other earlier caller mentioned, I mean, it's sort of like a loose definition. But I have a friend who teaches academically gifted kids, and we've talked about this over the years, and he tries to teach them to think, like, here's something, what do you think? I mean, you know, to option out, and of course they're a little bit higher IQ than most of the children, your average person. But it's interesting that people seem to be, you know, seduced by media, which you're right. It's basically a seductive medium, and it basically just, you know, it follows the money, and it goes to wherever, you know, violence sells. Hell, everything's violent. All the media's violent. But I'm just wondering if there's a way to counter that with a process. And I'm wondering, is that what you're doing? Is that what you're trying to do? Or, I mean, could you explain that?
Well, a lot of my work is really at the looking at the impact first, because you can't really design interventions or media literacy programs until you know what the impact of extensive exposure is. But we've done some work on designing small little programs, interventions we call them, where we teach children certain things and then we have them watch a program and then we compare them to a control group who hasn't heard the same kind of intervention. And we can show, even in that short context or short-term context, that children who receive certain kinds of instructional messages can will interpret what they see differently. So there's absolutely, it's part of what I'm doing. Now, do I go out and teach children? No, I teach college students. So, you know, most of what I'm doing is working in college level instruction, although I have done workshops for teachers and I've also done a lot of parent talks in the community to help parents think about the media differently.
Yeah, and that's important. I think, well, my friend says always that he could tell he taught it. What he didn't teach academically to get the kids, he taught, you know, regular students. And he said the amazing difference was the parental involvement. And I know it sounds like a kind of, like an old wine, but it's true. And I thank you. I really appreciate your work. Thanks.
Well, thanks for the call. One thing, and we're here in our midpoint, and I have some other calls we'll get to in a moment. One thing I want to make sure that we talk about, because I know that it's an interest of yours and something that you've done some looking at recently, is programming that's specifically said to be for children, children's programming. And I'm sure that when you talk to people in television and talk to people in commercial television about, you know, if you complain to them about the quality of programming, they'll say, well, we have programming for children. Come on. We have stuff and you can see it there. And so then the question becomes, well, if you take a look at children's programming, what's available on television across TV, what can you say about the quality of what's available?
Well, I hesitate to add this to a topic that when we were talking about violence and sex and all of these problematic kinds of topics, and now I'm going to shift to educational television, but then I'm going to be critical of it. So in some ways, I want to preface everything I say with the comment that there are good programs on television, and part of the goal, I guess, is to find where the quality is. And one of the things that parents may or may not be aware of is that today on commercial television there are programs that are labeled EI for educational informational, and they actually receive a little rating at the bottom of the screen before the program starts. Many parents don't even know about EI programs, but they exist, and they're there for a reason. They are actually mandated by law. Congress passed a law in 1990 called the Children's Television Act, and the law said that anybody, any commercial channel station using public airwaves has to provide programming for children, quality educational. Well, actually, it didn't say quality. It said it has to provide educational programming for children. And they went so far later in a revision of this act to actually specify, or the FCC did, that at a minimum, each station has to provide 3 hours a week of EI programming for children. So it's out there. And we did a study recently that looked at what does this EI programming look like. How good is it? Because it's actually the label is placed on programs by the media industry. There's no independent body of researchers or parents or educators who are deciding what gets an EI label. It's the industry that decides what gets the EI label and what they use to qualify for complying with this act. So we did a study recently to look at EI shows and to ask the question, how often are EI shows aired? So are broadcasters complying with the act? And then what do these shows look like? Are they educational? They have an EI label, but are they actually very educational? And people may be surprised to learn some of the programs that get EI labels. And I should tell you that when EI labels first began, or when they first became instituted, there was a lot of public concern because some of the programs that got EI labels were very suspect. There were cases where programs like, and I'm dating myself, but hopefully some of the listeners recognize these shows, The Flintstones, for example, got an EI rating at one point on one of the broadcast stations. And there are lots of other examples like that. And when they logged this in, a station would say, well, this teaches children what it's like to live
in prehistoric
times. And there were other examples of these where they were just ridiculous. So the EI label has not been used perhaps as consistently and as effectively as one might wish. So we asked the question in a recent study, well, how do these EI programs, what do they look like? And this was a systematic study of major markets across the country and what are they listing for EI programs. And then we went in and taped, recorded these programs, multiple episodes, and we actually coded them in terms of educational quality. And this was a study done here at the University of Illinois. We had actually undergraduate students trained as coders on this study, and they watched hours and hours of EI programming for children and judged it according to some systematic criteria that we had set up, things like how clear is the lesson, how well integrated is the lesson across the program. Does the program show kids how to apply the lesson to their real life behaviors and social experiences? And we found, in fact, unfortunately, that only about 1 in 8 of the programs that we coded in our sample of over 100 programs were actually high quality in nature. Many of these shows we judged to be moderately moderate in quality, and many of them were low in quality. And some of them, it was very challenging to figure out what the lesson was, and if it was hard for our undergraduate coders, it certainly would be hard for a child to figure out what the lesson is. So we have a ways to go in terms of EI programming. It's a great idea, and parents should look for these if they want to at least get a running start for what might be a good show. But in fact, there's a range in quality in these EI shows.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to our callers here. Just in a way, though, to connect this with what we were talking about before, when basically we were talking about bad, you know, TV bad, I guess I'd like to underscore the point that you made that says, look, what's important here is the content. It's what's on there.
That's right.
I'm sure that there are some people who say television is just irredeemable.
Right.
And I'm sure that you would say, and other people would say, well, that's going a little bit far.
Yeah.
You have to consider what's what's there.
Right.
And it can convey positive things. It can convey negative things. You just, as a parent, you have to the extent that you can be, involved in trying to have some control about what it is that your kids are watching.
That's right. That's right. And that's the big message, I guess. And even with the EI programming, you know, it's great that we have it. It's great that commercial broadcasters have to comply with this act. But in fact, it's probably not doing quite what the Congress had hoped it would do, or the FCC. And the other thing I should point out is that, as I mentioned, broadcasters are required by law to air 3 hours a week. And what we found is that 60% of the stations in our sample were airing just that, 3 hours and no more.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you think about 3 hours a week of EI programming, and then you reflect for a moment that children on average spend in this country 3 hours a day watching television, 6 hours a day with some form of media, 3 hours a day with television. So half of the time that they spend with media is still with television. You realize that we're really not providing a lot of EI programming relative to the amount of time children are spending in front of the screen.
Let's talk with some more folks here. Let's go to Montgomery, I think, our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good topic. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think I'm a advocate against some of this media bias, because I do firmly believe there is media bias out there solely for the fact of getting something on the air to get ratings. And I think it's all about ratings. I don't know how you feel about that, but whether it be a program for kids or not, I've been dead set against some of this stuff they show on the shows on TV at night, especially between the hours of, say, I don't know, maybe 5:30 and 9. Some of the CSIs, there's another one that's called The Unit. It's kind of very graphic. If your kids are watching that, And then on top of that, during the Iraq War, you know, in the beginning, they were showing graphic stuff there. I mean, to me, there's no logic behind it. They want to clamp down on radio communications like we're talking on now. But then the media, the visual parts, and it's kind of like the gentleman who called earlier that was in Southeast Asia, there's some of this stuff that's just crap. I'll tell you, this is an interesting story, and then I'll get off. But I had a friend that used to work for NASA years ago. And when I was growing up, I'm 52, when I was growing up, I was in an area where it was highly military. I mean, it was a military, basically a military base I grew up on. And everybody in the town that we lived in wasn't so much military families, but everybody was wrapped around that TV watching whether it be the space shuttle or the moon shots. And there was a lot of people that got interested right off the bat in going and being electronics engineers and anything to do with the sciences, whether it be in math or in engineering. Now it's like everybody wants to be either American Idol or sports. And I really firmly believe it, and I've asked kids this. What do you want to be when you grow up? Especially the guys that are, you know, in junior high and in high school. They want to be sports people because they see the high cost of what they make. And it, you know, they don't realize that there's life after sports. You know, I want to say, you know, once you spend 15, 20 years in sports, and then what do you do afterwards? And a lot of these big sports figures are basically broke. So, I mean, they don't learn the education of what life is really outside of Hollywood. And I think Hollywood has twisted everything around so much that there's no values and no responsibility out there. And I was just wondering how you feel about that. Thank you.
Okay. Well,
you addressed a lot of issues there. One thing you mentioned, though, was ratings. And I think that's a really important issue. I'm going to try to stick close to what I know, which is... And you're right to say that a lot of commercial television, most of commercial television, is really oriented toward financial profit. And that's one thing that many children don't realize. I even tell my college students this. You know, think about it. Most of the messages on commercial television are there to sell your eyeballs to the advertisers, which is a really strange and unusual way of thinking about it, but it's actually the truth. And I think a naive interpretation is, oh, these shows are here to entertain me. A more critical interpretation is these are programs that are there to underwrite the financial attraction of advertisers. And if you have that perspective, you look differently at why reality shows are on television and why some of the things are there that are airing between 6 and 9 or 5:30 and 9 at night. The one thing I can say, and I'm not doing this just because I'm on this station today, but public television is one place where the commercial enterprise is not yet completely overtaken the way that we view and select programming. And so in our study, which I didn't mention, I'm going to go back to the EI study, we found that the programming on public television was much higher quality, the programming for children, than the EI programming on commercial stations. So there still are pockets of excellence out there. It's just hard to find them sometimes. There are programs like Beekman's World, and there used to be Bill Nye the Science Guy, and programs that actually teach children how to think about careers and how to imagine being a scientist or how to think critically about knowing the world. And so they're there, and just like your example of watching, you know, the space shuttle takeoffs and such, there are examples. I'm sure there were children who watched the inauguration who felt inspired about political service. And so there are good things out there. They're just hard to find sometimes.
Well, thanks to the caller. And let's go next to someone in Chicago, line 3. Hello.
Yes, thinking can be very thoughtful if you stop to think about it, if you want to stop and think about it. But really, the point is, watching TV has resulted in a host of obesity, overwhelming the young population, and as well as nurturing couch potatoes for the future. But in a more educational mode, what do you think about the approach of Montessori and perhaps Waldorf in development of the body, you know, rather than going into the book world or the television world so much? Or what, do you have a view on that?
Yeah, it's really a little bit beyond my expertise. I stay pretty close to to studying the media, and I don't really study educational philosophies and different approaches to education. So I better just not comment on that. Thank you.
Well, but the caller sort of does make reference to a point we made earlier, and it's something that certainly was touched on in this recent study. And as we have discussed, and that is that, you know, if children or adults, for that matter, are spending a lot of time sitting in front of a screen, you know, to the extent that they do that and they're not physically active, that's not good for your health. And I guess that particularly in this recent study, the argument has been that maybe some of the problem we've started to see with kids being too heavy has something to do with lack of physical, you know, it may have to do with their eating habits are not healthy, which may get reinforced by media, but also has something to do with just lack of physical activity. Instead of running around, they're sitting in front of the screen.
I think the evidence shows that. But again, no, it's no simple causal direction. So that if the more you watch, the heavier you are. I mean, it's a variety of factors, including the diets and nutritional choices being made in the home, what you're watching, how much advertising you're seeing, how much snack fooding you're engaged in, what your parents are doing in terms of nutrition, your biology. I mean, it's a complex set of factors, but there's no doubt about it that at least in large-scale studies, the more time you spend sitting in front of a screen, especially great amounts, not just 2 hours, but I mean when we're sitting there for 4 to 6 hours a day as a child, that is a risk factor for obesity. Mm-hmm.
About 7-8 minutes left here. Maybe just again for anybody who might have tuned in, I should introduce one more time here our guest, Barbara Wilson. She's professor of communication here at the University of Illinois, interested in her research on social and psychological effects of media, particularly on young people. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The lines are full. We'll try to get in as many people as we can. And the next person in line, someone on a cell phone. That's line number 2. Hello.
Hello. I'm a professor of educational psychology here at the university, and I just wanted to follow up on the kind of the overarching theme of the complexity of the issue. So whenever I hear these arguments about the dangers of media on young people, I always kind of think about how in the 1800s there was a large movement to keep kids away from books because of their danger of young kids reading dangerous things and influential things that would make them moody or depressed or so forth. And given what we're worried about today, I think that's kind of curiously discordant with our feelings today. We would love to have kids sit and read books instead of watching TV, but there was a time when books, and especially certain kinds of books for certain kinds of people, were considered extremely dangerous and harmful. And the second thing I wanted to mention was that another complex part of the issue is that it's not just kids, right? So in the current issue of Psychological Science, there's an interesting study looking at people's willingness to help a woman who had dropped some crutches. And they placed this woman, a Confederate in the study, outside of a movie theater and compared people who were leaving a violent movie to people who were going in to see the violent movie, to people who were coming out of another movie that wasn't violent, and the adults who were leaving the violent movie were far less likely to help this woman get her crutches back than the other two groups. So it's not just children that are particularly vulnerable. Well, they are particularly vulnerable, but it's not just children who are vulnerable to the desensitization that certain types of content can cause, but it's anybody. And I guess those were the two points I wanted to bring up to kind of help back up the idea of the complexity of the issue that makes it hard to talk about it in any kind of simplistic forum, unlike this, you know, this sort of a program where you can actually talk at length about things.
Sure.
I really appreciate the show. Thank you.
Well, I thank you for the comment. You want to reflect on that at all?
Just full support of everything you're saying. It is a complex situation. I look at media as one of many risk factors, but also as one of many positive factors. And, you know, a lot of it involves or depends upon the home life, the peer group, the variety of other factors that children are living in. And then secondly, yes, there is evidence of desensitization with adults, so we shouldn't be smug and assume that we aren't influenced as well by the media as grown-ups, if you will. Thanks.
All right, well, let's go to another caller. This is someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
My question is that because of all the things that you stated earlier, we have chosen not to have a TV at all in our house. And I have two young kids, and we show them DVDs and, you know, selective material. But I'm worried about whether this, you know, not having a TV at all, will this have some type of a negative impact on them? You know, when you forbid something, it just becomes ever more interesting. So, I just wanted to throw that out and hear your comment, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you
very much. Well,
yeah, that's a really good question, and I congratulate you for making a choice that's running against the norm. You know, I think there are two things to just be aware of. One is that there are actually really good programs out there. So, for example, there's research on Sesame Street, which has been on the air for, you know, decades. And we now know that regular and repeated exposure to Sesame Street during preschool has actually been found to predict higher grades in high school and more leisure reading in high school. And this is after controlling for a lot of other factors like family environment and poverty and all kinds of things that might influence children's home lives. And so there are really positive things. Now, can you, if your child doesn't watch Sesame Street, does that mean your child won't read as much? No. I just share that with you so that you recognize that there are good things that your children might be missing out on. The one thing, though, that I think is more critical is this whole idea of a forbidden fruit. And that is, and we have evidence of that, when you tell children they can't do things that everybody else is doing. And we have the best evidence in the form of ratings. You know, children really want to see movies that are rated above their age group. This is like we have evidence that if you label things as not suitable for certain age groups, then children want to see it more than if it doesn't have that label on it. And so the challenge as your kids get older and start immersing, because it sounds like they may be younger, as they start participating more in the social world, your challenge, I think, will be to try to alleviate or combat the forbidden fruit idea. And then also, you know, it's very difficult to teach children to be critical media consumers if you don't have media. So when they finally do experience media, it may be in the homes of some friends when they're completely unprepared because they've never seen it before and you've never talked about it. And it could actually be pretty shocking and you know, pretty challenging for them. So those are just things to think about. I don't have an answer for you. You have to make your own choices. And I think you're already exercising a lot more parental involvement than a lot of people do, but they're just challenges to think about as you move forward in making decisions for your home.
Okay. Champagne line two is next here. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was prompted to call in after I heard one of the other callers, and just wanted to respond and also just affirm the values of public television, I think, are great. One of the other callers complained about some things that happened, it seems, after the watershed, late night airings of CSI and things like that, which are positioned, I thought, historically in media, in their time slots, to protect children and yet provide mature content for adults. And he also mentioned something about graphic images of the Iraq War, which... looking back at what we were able to see of the Vietnam War, particularly, I think, on CBS, we're not seeing as much, or at least under the previous administration, not seeing as much of what happened in that war or what's happening in this war as we saw of what has happened in that war. So that actually may be something that's valuable for children.
to know what's going on in their world, at least, and to learn that. But I wanted to point out WILO and WEIU in particular have children's programming starting from early morning through late afternoon, and it's all educational, it's all good. And if you've paid for digital cable, which I don't, you can get access to a channel called Sprout, which is all PBS children's programming. I really haven't let my kid watch Nickelodeon or any of the other channels, mainly stuck with PBS, and she was, and I'm not saying that my approach to parenting has all been television-based, but she was identifying words and doing basic addition and subtraction with, you know, holding up fingers and taking away a number and saying, okay, now what does that equal? And was potty trained and things like that well ahead of her third year of life. So the benefits of public television, Sesame Street in particular, I would say are very high.
Yeah, thank you. I think you're absolutely right, and those are great examples. The earlier comment you made was about viewing periods at night, and we used to actually have what was called the family viewing hour, and we don't have it anymore. So there was a period in the evening schedule when broadcasters were encouraged not to include certain kinds of programming that wasn't suitable for children, and that really has gone by the wayside. So we don't really have a watershed or a safety zone, for, if you will, on commercial television with regard to children.
We're going to have to stop. And my apologies, we have one more call that we can't take. I guess at the risk of repeating what we said already before, the takeaway message, I think, for parents should be is be involved in what it is their children are watching as much as you possibly can, and be selective. And there you might actually find some things that you'd feel okay about having your kids watch.
And maybe even good about having your kids watch.
Right. Well, there we've got to leave it. Our guest, Barbara Wilson, is Vice Provost for Academic Affairs here at the U of I. She's also Professor of Communication, very much interested in social and psychological effects of media, particularly on young people. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.